Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Jill Robbins, Bruce Alpert, Brian Lynn, and Dan Friedel. Later, we present a classic American short story originally adapted and recorded by the U.S. Department of State. But first,
when Betsy DeVos was selected by President Donald Trump to head the U.S. Education Department, some said she would do more to help charter and private schools than public schools. DeVos, a wealthy businesswoman from the state of Michigan, said that is not true. Let's be honest. There's no such thing as a cure-all in education, DeVos said in a recent speech. Even the best school in the country, with the best trained educators and the most resources, will not be the perfect fit for every child. Betsy DeVos attended a private religious school in Michigan and also sent her four children to religious schools. She was a former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. She also led a group, the Great Lakes Education Project, which successfully pushed Michigan's legislature to allow public charter schools. Public charter schools are mostly run by private groups and can operate independently of local school districts. DeVos also supports government vouchers that help low-income parents pay to send their children to private schools. The Senate voted February 7th to approve her nomination as Education Secretary by a vote of 51-50. Vice President Mike Pence gave her the needed 51st vote.
Her opponents said she did not have enough education training and would move federal money to private and charter schools at the expense of public schools. Public schools educate 90% of America's K-12 students. But defenders said DeVos, as an education outsider, would bring important reforms to a system that has underperformed for poor children. First-term Republican President Donald Trump is a supporter of vouchers. As a candidate for president, he proposed $20 billion in federal money to help parents send their children to private schools. His first budget proposal as president calls for $1 billion to allow states to move forward with more school choice. It includes $250 million to help low-income students attend private schools and another $167 million to start or expand charter schools. As Trump's Secretary of Education, DeVos said the budget proposal is aimed at increasing choices for parents. A system that denies parents the freedom to choose the education that best suits their children's individual and unique needs denies them a basic human right, DeVos said in a June speech to the National Alliance for Charter Schools.
But there is little agreement about the performance of students who attend charter schools or use vouchers to attend private schools. One of the largest voucher programs in the United States operates in the Midwest American state of Indiana. Here is how the Indiana program works. It provides vouchers of up to $4,500, enough to cover tuition at many, but not all, private schools in the state. To get a full voucher, a family of four can earn no more than $45,000 a year. When serving as Indiana's governor, Pence, the current vice president, oversaw a big increase in private school vouchers in his state. Joseph Waddington of the University of Kentucky and Mark Behrens of Notre Dame University recently released a study of Indiana's voucher program. They looked at students in grades 3 through 8 who moved from public schools to private schools. On average, the students saw drops in math scores during the first and second year at their new private school. The study found no difference in test scores in English language. Other studies found problems with voucher programs in Louisiana and Ohio. Waddington and Behrens said government-supported private school voucher programs operate in 16 of the 50 American states and Washington, D.C. Robert Enloe is president of an Indiana group called EdChoice. It supports private school voucher programs.
About the research suggesting declines in math performance and no change in English test scores, Enloe said it is because most students who attend new schools, no matter how good, have a period of adjustment. For many students, it takes time to adjust to the more difficult subjects offered at their new private schools, he said. Many parents want their children to attend religious schools that offer morality and values-based programs. Milwaukee is the first American city to create a scholarship program that helps low-income parents pay for tuition at private schools. The program started 26 years ago. The city's public school superintendent is Darianne Driver. She said voucher programs take money away from public schools. After 26 years, it is only now that private schools receiving vouchers are being asked to show their test scores. So there has been no accountability, no way to compare them with public schools, Driver said. Despite their differences on vouchers and other programs, Driver is not giving up on DeVos. She met with the secretary and had a telephone discussion with her. Driver said she is pleased with the discussion. DeVos said she is willing to look at federal rules that Driver and other local school officials believe are unfair to public schools.
Both supporters and opponents of vouchers and charter schools agree that the proposed education spending cuts of 13.5% in President Trump's budget are wrong. Driver said the cuts would make it more difficult for schools to provide special services for low-income students. Jacqueline Cooper is president of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. She praised Trump for supporting federal money for private school vouchers and charter schools. But she added that the proposed cut in federal education money is the wrong way to put families and children first. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Bruce Alpert.
Customers at a Washington, D.C. falafel shop are praising the tasty food as well as the owner's efforts to help refugees. Falafel Inc. is located in the Georgetown area, one of the city's most expensive places to eat and live. Many people cannot believe they can buy a falafel sandwich at the shop for $3. The shop opened just 2 months ago. It stays very busy, especially around midday when workers in the area are buying lunch. But the shop is different from most others. The owner, Ahmed Ashgar, gives some of the money he earns to the United Nations World Food Program. For every $10 Falafel Inc. makes, he donates about 50 cents to the UN agency. This is enough to feed one refugee for a day. Ashkar told VOA that while there are many ways to help refugees, he found a way that works well with his business. The idea to help refugees by selling falafels is welcomed by customers like Nick Wright.
I think what they're doing with the refugees is a very good cause, and I support it.
Lunch buyer Roland Speer agrees.
Food is delicious, and hearing about the owner's story before we went in was really inspiring, and I think it makes the food all that more enjoyable.
Ashkar grew up on the falafels cooked by his Palestinian mother, and he makes them exactly the same way for his shop. Since the shop only makes falafels and small sides, it keeps costs low. Donating 50 cents might not sound like a lot, but the money adds up. The shop has already donated enough money to feed almost 10,000 refugees. Ashkar said he is looking into opening up more falafel shops around the world. He has a goal of at least 100 franchises, which would allow him to feed about 1 million refugees a year. But he wants to do more than just feed refugees. He also wants to employ them in shops and eventually give them a chance to be more than a worker.
We're looking at a place where the refugee can actually become, after 24 months of employment, an actual owner of the stores themselves.
Ashkar said every day the number of worldwide refugees seems to grow. So he thinks expanding his business is one way to help solve a problem that he sees getting worse before it gets better. I'm Brian Lynn.
Whiskey has grown popular around the world in the last 10 years. New distilleries are opening, and old distilleries are trying to produce more whiskey. But as people make more whiskey, they are also making more whiskey waste. Huge amounts of leftover grain and liquid. Distillers do not have many options for what to do with this material. Some give it away to farms to feed animals. Others pay over $300,000 per year to dispose of it. And now, a company in Edinburgh, Scotland, called Celtic Renewables, is trying to make fuel with it. To understand whiskey waste, you have to understand how whiskey is made. First, distillers take barley, corn, or rye and turn the grain into mash. Then they combine the mixture with yeast. The yeast causes fermentation and creates alcohol. Distillers heat the mash, create steam, and then cool it down quickly. Alcohol vapor turns into liquid, ages, and eventually becomes whiskey. The used grain and water remain. In Scotland, the leftovers are called draff and pot ale. In 2015, Celtic Renewables received money from the Scottish government for their idea to turn draff and pot ale into fuel. The money has allowed the company to create a factory able to produce 500,000 liters of biofuel each year. The company hopes to open the factory next year. Martin Tangney is the president of Celtic Renewables. He thinks Scotland alone has enough raw materials from the whiskey industry to produce 50 million liters of biofuel right away. Tangney recently drove a car powered by his company's fuel around a university in Scotland. The goal is not to replace gasoline completely. It is to reduce gasoline consumption and figure out what to do with the leftover material from distilling whiskey. Tangney said his product can make up to 15% of commercial gasoline without drivers having to modify their engines. The whiskey industry will now have a sustainable and reliable way of disposing of their residue, Tangney said. Plus, we'll create a brand new industry out of something that has no value whatsoever. I'm Dan Friedel.
Now we present the first part of the classic American short story, Hearts and Crosses, by O. Henry, originally adapted and recorded by the U.S. Department of State.
Baldy Woods reached for a drink and got it. When Baldy wanted something, he usually got it. But this is not Baldy's story. Now he took his third drink, which was larger than the first and the second. Baldy had been listening to the troubles of a friend. Now Baldy was going to tell his friend what to do. So the friend was buying him the drinks. This was the right thing for the friend to do. "I'd be king if I were you," said Baldy. He said it loudly and strongly. Webb Yeager moved his wide hat back on his head. He put his fingers in his yellow hair and moved it about. It now looked wilder than before. But this did not help him to think better. Therefore, he also got another drink.
"If a man marries a queen, it ought not make him nothing," said Webb. Here was his real problem.
"Surely not," said Baldy. "You ought to be a king, but you're only the queen's husband. That's what happens to a man in Europe if he marries the king's daughter. His wife becomes a queen, but is he a king? No. His only duty is to appear with the queen in pictures and be the father of the next king. That's not right. Yes, Webb, you are only the queen's husband. And if I were you, I'd turn everything upside down and I would be king." Baldy finished his drink.
"Baldy," said Webb, "you and I have been cowboys together for years. We've been riding the same road since we were very young. I wouldn't talk about my family to anyone but you. You were working on the Nopalito Ranch when I married Santa McAllister. I was foreman then. What am I now? Nothing."
"Well, when old McAllister was cattle king of West Texas," continued Baldy, "you were important. You told people what to do. Your commands were as strong as his."
"That was true," said Webb, "until he discovered that I wanted to marry Santa. Then he sent me as far away from the ranch house as he could. When the old man died, they started to call Santa the cattle queen. Now, I tell the cattle what to do. That's all. She takes care of all the business. She takes care of all the money. I can't sell any cattle, not one animal. Santa is the queen and I'm nothing."
"I would be king if I were you," said Baldy Woods again. "When a man marries a queen, he ought to be the same as she is. Plenty of people think it's strange, Webb. Your words mean nothing on the Nopalito Ranch. Mrs. Yeager is a fine little lady, but a man ought to be the head of his own house."
Webb's brown face grew long with sadness. With that expression in his wild yellow hair and his blue eyes, he looked like a schoolboy who had lost his leadership to another strong boy. Yet his tall body looked too strong for such a thing to happen to him. "I'm riding back to the ranch today," he said. It was easy to see that he did not want to go. "I have to start some cattle on the road to San Antonio tomorrow morning." "Well, I'll go with you as far as Dry Lake," said Baldy. The two friends got on their horses and left the little town where they had met that morning. At Dry Lake, they stopped to say goodbye. They had been riding for miles without talking. But in Texas, talk does not often continue steadily. Many things may happen between words. But when you begin to talk again, you're still talking about the same thing. So now Webb added something to the talk that began 10 miles away.
"You remember, Baldy, there was a time when Santa was different. You remember the days when old McAllister kept me away from the ranch house. Remember how she would send me a sign that she wanted to see me? Old McAllister said that he would kill me if I came near enough. You remember the sign she used to send, Baldy? The picture of a heart with a cross inside it?"
"Me?" cried Baldy. "Sure, I remember. Every cowboy on the ranch knew that sign of the heart and the cross. We would see it on things sent out from the ranch. We would see it on anything. It would be on newspapers, on boxes of food. Once I saw it on the back of the shirt of a cook that McAllister sent from the ranch."
"Santa's father made a promise that she wouldn't write to me or send me any word. That heart and cross sign was her plan. When she wanted to see me, she would put that mark on something that she knew I would see. And when I saw it, I traveled fast to the ranch that same night. I would meet her outside the house."
"Well, we all knew it," said Baldy. "But we never said anything. We wanted you to marry Santa. We knew why you had that fast horse. When we saw the heart and the cross on something from the ranch, we always knew your horse was going to go fast that night."
"The last time Santa sent me the sign," said Webb, "was when she was sick. When I saw it, I got on my horse and started. It was a 40-mile ride. She wasn't at our meeting place. I went to the house. Old McAllister met me at the door.
'Did you come here to get killed?' he said. 'I won't kill you this time. I was going to send for you. Santa wants you. Go in that room and see her. Then come out here and see me.'
Santa was lying in bed very sick, but she smiled and put a hand in mine, and I sat down by the bed, mud and riding clothes and all.
'I could hear you coming for hours, Webb,'
she said.
'I was sure you would come. You saw the sign?'
'I saw it,' I said.
'It's our sign,'
she said.
'Hearts and crosses, to love and to suffer. That's what they mean.'
And old Dr. Musgrove was there. And Santa goes to sleep, and Dr. Musgrove touches her face, and he says to me, 'You were good for her, but go away now. The little lady will be all right in the morning.' Old McAllister was outside her room. 'She's sleeping,' I said. 'Now you can start killing me. You have plenty of time. I haven't anything to fight with.' Old McAllister laughs and says to me,
'Killing the best foreman in West Texas is not good business. I don't know where I could get another good foreman. I don't want you in the family, but I can use you on the Nopalito if you stay away from the ranch house. You go up and sleep, and then we'll talk.'"
The two men prepared to separate. They took each other's hand.
"Bye, Baldy," said Webb. "I'm glad I saw you and had this talk."
With a sudden rush, the two riders were on their way. Then Baldy pulled his horse to a stop and shouted. Webb turned.
"If I were you,"
came Baldy's loud voice,
"I would be king."
At 8 the following morning, Bud Turner got off his horse at the Nopalito Ranch House. Bud was the cowboy who was taking the cattle to San Antonio. Mrs. Yeager was outside the house putting water on some flowers. In many ways, Santa was like her father, King McAllister. She was sure about everything. She was afraid of nothing. She was proud. But Santa looked like her mother. She had a strong body and a soft prettiness. Because she was a woman, her manners were womanly. But she liked to be queen, as her father had liked to be king. Webb stood near her, giving orders to two or three cowboys. "Good morning," said Bud. "Where do you want the cattle to go? To Barber's, as usual?" The queen always answered such a question. All the business, buying, selling, and banking, had been held in her hands. Care of the cattle was given to her husband. When King McAllister was alive, Santa was his secretary and his helper. She had continued her work, and her work had been successful. But before she could answer, the queen's husband spoke.
"You drive those cattle to Zimmerman's and Nesbitt's. I spoke to Zimmerman about it."
Bud turned, ready to go.
"Wait," called Santa quickly.
She looked at her husband with surprise in her gray eyes.
"What do you mean, Webb?"
she asked.
"I never deal with Zimmerman and Nesbitt. Barber has bought all the cattle from this ranch for 5 years. I'm not going to change."
She said to Bud Turner,
"Take those cattle to Barber."
Bud did not look at either of them. He stood there waiting.
"I want those cattle to go to Zimmerman and Nesbitt," said Webb.
There was a cold light in his blue eyes.
"It's time to start," said Santa to Bud. "Tell Barber we'll have more cattle ready in about a month."
Bud allowed his eyes to turn and meet Webb's.
"You take those cattle," said Webb,
"to Barber,"
said Santa quickly.
"Let's say no more about it. What are you waiting for, Bud?"
"Nothing,"
said Bud. But he did not hurry to move away, for man is man's friend, and he did not like what had happened.
"You heard what she said," cried Webb. "We do what she commands."
He took off his hat and made a wide movement with it, touching the floor.
"Webb,"
said Santa,
"what's wrong with you today?"
"I'm acting like the queen's fool,"
said Webb.
"What can you expect? Let me tell you, I was a man before I married a cattle queen. What am I now? Something for the cowboys to laugh at. But I'm going to be a man again."
Santa looked at him.
"Be reasonable, Webb," she said quietly. "There's nothing wrong. You take care of the cattle, I take care of the business. You understand the cattle. I understand the business better than you do. I learned it from my father."
"I don't like kings and queens," said Webb, "unless I'm one of them myself." "All right, it's your ranch. Barber gets the cattle."
Webb's horse was tied near the house. He walked into the house and brought out the supplies he took on long rides. These he began to tie on his horse. Santa followed him. Her face had lost some of its color. Webb got on his horse. There was no expression on his face except a strange light burning in his eyes.
"There's some cattle at the Hondo waterhole," he said. "They ought to be moved. Wild animals have killed three of them. I did not remember to tell Sims to do it. You tell him."
Santa put a hand on the horse and looked her husband in the eye.
"Are you going to leave me, Webb?"
she asked quietly.
"I'm going to be a man again,"
he answered.
"I wish you success,"
she said with a sudden coldness. She turned and walked into the house. Webb Yeager went to the southeast as straight as he could ride. And when he came to the place where the sky and the earth seemed to meet, he was gone. Those at the Nopalito knew nothing more about him. Days passed, then weeks, then months. But Webb Yeager did not return.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.